So Rekai and I have two Telegram threads. One is muted, so that way it's things that are not important, and then one is unmuted. And this is in the unmuted thread today when I got in. So I got into the studio today about 7 o'clock, 7 p.m., 7:30. It's Labor Day, and we're recording user error. And this is the text message. Oh, 7:38 p.m. This is when I sent it to Rekai. This is the message I sent. Can you confirm you're alive? Because something smells super dead, and I want to make sure it's not you.
I did in fact confirm I was alive, by the way.
But you know, I because I walked into the studio, here's how it went. I walked into the studio and my lady says, "Oh my God, you've got to take out the garbage right now." And I'm like, "You're right. It smells really bad in here. I better take out the garbage." I open up the garbage and I get hit with a bouquet of wonderful smells. I'm not kidding you. I said to her, I turned to her and I said, "Hadiya, this is the best smelling thing in the studio right now. It is not the garbage. The garbage smells amazing." And I'm not kidding. And so then we like started smelling the sink. And you know what? Legitimately, the sink smelled great. We go into the bathroom and the bathroom smelled so wonderfully clean. Like, I'm like, whose bathroom is this? This smells great.
Did you check your studio bathroom, Chris?
No, I did not check my personal bathroom. But so I check all of the, we even look in the microwave and the oven, like, did something get left in here? And nothing. We cannot track the smell. And I realize, if Rekai is up in his den, I have no idea if he's alive or not. He could be dead. And like, I could be smelling his dead rotting body when I walk into the studio. So I had to send him, and my first thought isn't go up and check on him. My first thought is send him a telegram.
Funny. I'll tell you something else that's kind of funny that dawns on me. I have a muted thread with Rekai. You have a muted thread with Rekai, and I have a muted thread with you. So we all have muted threads with each other.
But we don't have one where we're all collected together.
That could actually be useful.
This is that time. That's what we're here to do today. Because it's early in the show, I feel like it's okay to stop and say thank you to everybody for all the super great feedback about the show.
Yeah.
That has been really encouraging. And I said I wanted to have something for the patrons next week, so stay tuned for that. I do have something for the user error supporters out there, but thank you to everybody who've given us a comments on YouTube or sent us in feedback at error@jupiterbroadcasting.com or the nice comments in the subreddit. It's really cool. It's great to be here with you guys, so thank you very much for all the nice feedback. So I wanted to say that right up front before we got into it. Special thank you to our YouTube commenters who were super awesome and engaging, and we had great conversations. I saw Rekai jumping in there. I jumped in there a little bit. Noah probably did, but also don't forget you can go to error.show. That'll jump you right to the page for the new show. We also last week launched an MP4 RSS feed because, you know, folks like to watch the video version. Why not? So we've got that available as well. You can throw that in your podcatcher. Also, a special shout out to the Pod Addict podcast player. They did some special work for us to make sure that the user error feed got delivered nice and smooth to Pod Addict players. So special thanks to them, too. And if you are in Pocket Cast, we've been trending for the last couple of days. So why not go over there and give us a subscription and help us bump up the numbers? I got a question to ask you, Rekai.
Mm-hmm.
Pretend like Noah's not on the call right now and he's not listening.
Yeah, he is kind of an asshole.
Do you think he's got a screw loose, doesn't he, when it comes to how hard he works?
Yeah.
He is a maniac. So, I mean, just to put it in perspective, he's like Batman and Spider-Man in one person.
Let's put it this way. He is the only person who I can often message at 3 o'clock in the morning.
West Coast time.
Yeah, and not be afraid that he might be awake or might be sleeping.
He's always awake.
Yeah.
And how many miles did you just drive in the last day there, Mr. Noah?
Well, 1,300. Well, yeah, 1,300 on the way home. But so 2,600 round trip,
yeah.
Plus a little couple, spats here and there.
You are. I mean, what is it? What is it? What's wrong with you? Why do you do this? Like nobody would be upset if you said, "I'm just busy. I can't make it. And we're gonna have to do it on Tuesday." Like, so, what is it? What is it that drives you? Because I feel like, honestly, if it wasn't Jupiter, a crazy Jupiter broadcasting thing, mm-hmm. you'd probably fill it with some other crazy thing, like switching somebody to Linux or a ham thing or a gun thing or God knows what. I mean, it just feels like this is how you operate.
Well, and can I say that I think that if Noah did slow down and got more sleep, some of his memory issues might go away.
Yeah, maybe. So I think a big part of it is that I don't do anything for money. I got over that a long time ago, and so I don't do anything for money. I don't you can't pay me enough to do something anymore. I don't do things for that anymore these days. These days, I do things because I'm passionate about them, right? I'm passionate about switching people to Linux. I'm passionate about a school who has an IT director that is converting their Windows boxes to Linux, and then he's going to teach these kids how to use Linux-based software. And so they are going to grow up from middle school on thinking that the way you do broadcasting, the way it's done, is with Linux. And if this goes forward just a little bit more, they're going to get all the way through high school and say, well, geez, and if anyone ever tries to tell them otherwise, they're going to say, no, we did that. We did it this way for like 9 years. I know exactly how we can set up a broadcasting studio. We can do it for a couple $1,000. I get passionate about stuff like that. And that was, back in 2009, that's what drove me to start Altusby to begin with. I was at my current employer, and there was a paycheck there. I was putting food on the table. There was nice people at work there, but there was no passion.
Essentially, there's another way to look at this. Mm-hmm. You are unemployable. You have to work for yourself in a sense, because you have to do something that interests you, and you have to have a job that is flexible enough where if something doesn't strike your interest anymore, you can pivot the company into an area that does interest you.
So when I think about where I want Altuspeed to be in 10 years, or even the kind of change I want to affect in Jupiter Broadcasting, right? Because so this weekend was largely about Jupiter Broadcasting and how I can move that forward. And that's because I think Jupiter Broadcasting has vision. I think that it has an actual purpose beyond just let's collect a paycheck, let's get more viewers. No, it's not about that. When you and I and Rikai sit down together, very rare is the conversation centered around, how do we get more viewers? Certainly it comes up, because at the end of the day, we got to put food on the table, right? But that's not the core focus. The core focus is how do we bring...
To our detriment, probably.
Well, yeah. Actually, no, it really is. Because we consistently take... And it's one of the things I really respect, and I think why I have such a... Not only a high respect for Jupiter Broadcasting, but why I'm willing to go to extreme measures to support the cause, is because we intentionally take steps that are good for the vision, but not necessarily... not necessarily good for the bank, right? Mm-hmm. Spending a week troubleshooting Jitsi.me and then spending almost a year prior to that trying every solution in the book just to be able to say that we can do video production on Linux, that's not necessarily a cost-effective way to run a business, but it shows that we have a focus on vision. And I think
I totally agree with you, but you're not convincing me that you didn't become a small business owner simply so that way you could do that, that being what you want. You couldn't really do this in another profession.
I think it's because they look at the bottom line. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I became a full-time podcaster is I made a much better living doing the IT thing, but I couldn't really do it the way I wanted to do it. And I too got really burned out on fixing XP computers. And Rikai and I have been talking a little bit back and forth just behind the scenes, as he's sort of getting really serious about committing to content production to a community on his Patreon, which we talked about last week. Over this weekend, you were standing up some Arch servers.
Yeah.
Which, Arch and server? Why did you go Arch?
Basically because I'm used to it and it was easy to set up.
That's a super good reason, especially when you don't have to manage like 1,000 systems.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? 1, 2, 3 servers, not a big deal.
Also because I don't want to go looking for PPAs for an old version of Ubuntu.
What was it, the thing you were telling me about that was a nice management system for a Minecraft server?
It's called mark.to. It's kind of just a wrapper script that gives you a command line user interface that...
Like N curses?
Yeah. Tells you what people are saying in the chat, the CPU usage, how many people are online. It's pretty nice.
So super nice way to set up a Minecraft server. Yeah. So Rikai and I have been talking about that transition when you start to... juggle multiple things. Like you've got the full-time gig, you've got the hobby project, you got some things you're doing on the side, and they're each starting to take up a lot of capacity of yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, for you, I don't actually know the story about you, and I'm a little curious because it's really interesting. We'll talk about Rikai's situation here in a moment, but he's sort of at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. You are at the other end of this, but I don't know what was Noah pre-Altuspeed? Was he working for somebody? Did he do Windows support? Did he get sick of it and start a side business?
So I was working for a medical software company, and we had a lot of machines, and we bought a new server, and as on site for a clinic, and I was working on the server, and the policy the company had at the time, which was a fantastic policy, and I've since adopted it, was you could, what they call professional development, you could take a piece of equipment home with you no matter what the cost was, and you could do whatever you wanted with it as long as when a work order was issued to put that piece of equipment into production, it was returned within 24 hours. Hmm. And so they ordered this brand new $5,500 server, and it shows up, and nobody's using it, and I say, I'm going to PD it. So I take it home, and I didn't have an operating system. So I knew that Linux was a thing. I kind of knew that it existed. We actually did talk about this once in the last episode.
Yeah, but this is starting to ring a bell.
Yeah, and so I basically installed Red Hat on it. And I installed IBM Domino, which was a really really great piece of software, and not really well known. And I think a lot of people that make fun of it just don't really understand it.
It just sounds old. That's exactly what it is.
And it is old. But installed Domino on it, and I tell my boss, I said, you know, it's the craziest thing. You know, at the time we had a Windows 2000 server, and the Windows 2000 server had this irritating problem of assigning multiple IP addresses or the same IP address to multiple machines, which is kind of an issue when your job is to be a DHCP server. Right. So our answer was just we're going to restart this thing every 15 days. And yep. So anyway, I was telling my boss, I said, you know, it's the darndest thing. I installed the server and I had it running, and like it's been like a month and the thing hasn't nothing screwed up. And he's like, really? I'm like, yeah, that's incredible. I said,
what version of Windows was it back then? Do you remember?
2000. It was Windows 2000 server.
OK, so did you have to mess with NT4 at all? Mm-hmm.
It was the very beginning days. I was working under somebody at the time.
NT4 and early Windows 2000 were unstable. Windows is not like it was back then. It has gotten much, much better. Yeah.
I agree. And most of my butthurt from Windows comes from those days, to be honest.
Yeah, it was legitimately like all of the blue screen of death jokes and all of that were valid and real back then.
Yeah.
The pain was real.
So, you know, we get to like 4 months and he says, bring that server back. I said, no problem. So I go and bring it back and he goes, so how did it work? I said, great. I never shut it off the entire time. He goes, that can't be right. And I said, yeah. So he takes it and he goes, let's put our database on there. Let's see if it works. So he takes my server. And mind you, I've never installed Linux before, really. And I've certainly never installed Domino on top of Linux. And it had a funny name and all the directories were just like work one, try two, try three, all this, you know, weird stuff that you do when you're just trying something out. I had no intention of ever having anyone see it, much less use it. And he puts a copy of our production database on it and says, let's see how this runs. And I am scared out of my mind, right? Because I'm like, this is going to go all sorts of sideways.
My name is attached to this.
Exactly. It goes for a year and works flawlessly. So he goes, I want to deploy this everywhere. I want to be using this everywhere. This is great. I want to put this everywhere. And I said, slow down, cowboy. I have no idea how I even did that. Like, I don't do magic and figs. I don't remember how I did that. I don't even know. I don't even understand how any of it works. And, you know, this is back. I mean, to tell you how early days this was for me, this is when I had, it was obviously a graphical interface, and I'm opening a terminal window and typing ./ and then the name of the executable and then pressing enter and putting a note, sticky note on the monitor saying, don't close this window. Right. So he tells me, he goes, well, what do you need to be able to deploy this wide scale? And I said, I need to know more about this operating system. So they paid for me to go to a 2-week like boot camp to learn about Red Hat. And so I come back like floored. Right. Because first of all, I sat down at a computer and for the first time in my life, I didn't install Linux on it. Somebody else did. And I got to work on it. And, you know, I come back and I'm like, oh, I learned so many things. And you can do this thing called SSH and we can get in remotely. And there's this NoHub thing, which means we don't have to have that window open and I can start this thing. And you know, and that was about the time virtualization was taking off. And I'm like, I don't even think we need to buy a $5,500 server. I think we can host it over here at these, you know, we can pay this, you know, $15 a month or whatever. And we could, and I'm just going on and on and on. And so he goes, you know what? I don't care. Just do it. And so we started moving more and more of this company's clients over to, these Linux servers that we were deploying. And then eventually I said, you know, IBM makes notes for Linux. Why don't we try running it on the workstation? Because workstation, we fixed the server problem, but we're constantly restoring all these workstations. So he goes, yeah, it's worked great. Let's do that. So we start doing it on all these workstations. And that's like a major success. And everything's going great. And then restructuring the company and different company comes in. Guy from Canada is doing some things. And first thing I get told is, yeah, we're going back to Windows. And I'm like, you know what? No, we're not. I mean,
I've come this far. I have learned so much. I've discovered this new land.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the thing is, it was like, I had, you know, for the first like 5 years of my career, it was all, everything was, they were teaching you Windows and they're telling me Windows. And I just accepted that, it was small little lies. Like you just have to reinstall your operating system every 6 months to keep your, that's okay. That's a normal thing you have to do. People telling me stuff like that, I got so butthurt when I finally figured out that, no, actually, I can install an operating system and I'll reinstall it when I decide it's time, not because my computer no longer boots up because it takes 10 minutes, you know? And so I quit my job. And I would never recommend anyone do that. In fact, you know, you're talking about...
Did you have clients in lined up when you did this?
No, I didn't.
What do you mean,
stupid thing to do. I just quit my job.
You didn't have anybody that knew Noah's phone number that you could go charge to do work?
No, what I did... I mean, I had an idea, but I didn't... I didn't actually put it into practice.
That is full-on straight crazy.
It was stupid in retrospect. And then, so this is September of 2009, okay? December of 2009, I file the paperwork to form AltaSpeed and do all that jazz. I have everything ready. February of 2010, I find out my wife is pregnant with her first kid. Right. And I'm like, I've ruined my life. I have ruined my life.
So that's a little earlier than I was planning.
Right. Crap. And I'm in college. I'm a full-time college student.
Yeah.
And I've just formed a company, which I paid $200 to tell the state that I made nothing. I don't have a steady income at this point, really. I have a part-time thing that I was kind of helping out, helping over at my dad's clinic. And so I'm getting some part-time income, but really no actual like way to produce some, you know, real cash flow. Mm-hmm. And so I start, you know, the hustle and grind. And I basically went to these guys that were previously clients and I said, hey, you know what? You guys have all these Linux servers. They're going to tell you, you got to go buy new ones. You don't. Actually, they'll run for the next 10 years. I'll manage them for you. You give me X dollars a month and I'll make sure they keep running. I know the software. I'm the one that set it up. So, yeah, sure, we do that. So I got a couple of those guys to sign up. And then I was doing small little deals, kind of doing the hand to mouth thing. And this lady calls me and she says, I need my Windows laptop cleaned up or something like that. And I said, all right, well, you're going to put Linux on it and here's what we're going to do. And I kind of walk her through the whole process. And I had class that day. And so I asked a friend of mine to go take care of this for me and he blew her off. So she calls and she's very upset. And I said, no problem. I'll come right over and I'll deal with it. And she goes, no, I don't want you to come over. What I want you to do is I'll send it to work with my husband. You can go meet up with him. And he's over at this hotel. And I said, okay, great. So I go to this hotel and I say, I'm looking for, and the guy's name is, and they said, yeah, down that hallway, up that, the staircase. So I go up and here's this gigantic room covered with windows all the way around. There's this big, huge mahogany wood door. And I kind of knock on the door and I look and there's his name on this plaque. And I'm, oh, this is the guy. I'm like, geez, man, he's not the janitor. He's something else. So he walks in and goes, hey, my name is Vinay and I'm the general manager. And I'm like, holy crap. So I sit down and he hands me his wife's laptop and I put Ubuntu on there and I explain what it is we're doing and all this and I hand it back to him. And he goes, oh, that's incredible. Yeah, it's much faster. And oh, that's great. And he goes, you did that really fast. I said, yeah, I've done it once or twice before. And he goes, that's incredible. He goes, you guys do corporate work, right? And I'm like, yep, we do corporate work. And he goes, great. Can I get a price list and your terms and a contract sent over? And I'm like,
sure.
Well, yeah, exactly. So he could just see it on my face, right? And he's like, you have no idea what I'm talking about. And I'm like,
oh, really?
No. He saw right through it. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, all right, come over here. He's like, here's what you're going to do. You need a price list. It needs to contain these pieces of information. It has to be formatted kind of like this. Then you want a contract. You want to shed yourself from liability. He's walking me through all of these little, like, this is kind of how you get started, right? And he goes, now go home, do all that, and then email that to me officially. And I said, okay. So I go back and do exactly what he says. And I send it back into him. And a day later he goes, okay, congratulations. You got the contract. You're approved now as our agent. Yeah. So now we manage more hotel networks than anyone else in the Grand Forks and Fargo, you know, area. And then plus, you know, we've moved on to other businesses and stuff like that. And so I've thought a lot about why that was successful and the things that got me there. And I think the biggest thing is you have to use your labor and your sweat and grind to gain a client's trust to begin with, right? Because they're not going to let you just take over. And so if you walk into a hotel and just say, I want to manage your network, they're going to tell you no, right? But if you go in there and you say, listen, you let me do this job for you, whatever it is, and I'll come solve this problem for you, and I'll do that for free. And at the end of 1 week or at the end of whatever, I'll make myself so valuable to you, you won't be able to kick me out the door. You take an approach like that, they have nothing to lose. And the thing is, I didn't understand it at the time, I do now. It's just a very primitive form of advertising, right? You give a free sample of your work.
You know, what strikes me about your story is it seems like a huge part of you kicking off your business was walking into a guy's office and switching that laptop over to Linux.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which blows my mind.
Well, on top of that, not only that, but he only got to that point because his friend blew a lady off.
Yeah. So I want to pause right here because Rekai is is Rikai is in a phase that I want to talk about here for a moment, because I know as a business owner, you and I have both gone through this, and it's kind of, I think it's something that we've been intending to talk about. So let's pause there. So I'll take a moment right now and thank our patrons at patreon.com/today. Thank you, everybody who's enjoyed this show and wanted to thank us by supporting us. We've picked up some new supporters. I really appreciate that. And I wanted to come up with a new tier to say, like, you support the user error level, and this is the price you pay because it's great. And this is like a number we've decided that this is the user error number. That seemed like a good idea, as like a badge of honor. Like, I thank you for the user error show. This is the amount I want to support you at patreon.com/today.
$7,000.
Right. So then I talked to Angela about it, and she's like, well, here's why that's bad for, like, 13 different reasons. And there were, like, at least five of them were, like, really solid reasons. And I was like, all right, okay, those are five solid reasons. And, like, another four that were pretty solid. I'm like, okay, I can't argue with that. And then here's what I realized we could do, because this is something that I think people would really enjoy, and it could be a thank you to the people who are supporting the show over on Patreon. It's simple, but it's, like, something I've gotten a lot of requests. You know, when we post the video of this here show, we put up a background for the waveforms to be in front of. Mm-hmm. I'm going to post the full high resolution, like they're often like 2K or above resolutions of those wallpaper images, as long as I have the right to do it, up on the Patreon page. So when a user error episode gets posted, you can find the corresponding background image if you want to use that as your wallpaper up for our patrons. And that'll just be one way to say thank you for supporting the show at patreon.com/today, which supports all of the Jupiter Broadcasting shows. And if we can get a good uptick in numbers to support the show, I would love to long-term keep this ad-free. We'll see where that will go. It'll be in the hands of our patrons. In User Error Episode 2, Rikai announced his Patreon page at patreon.com/Rikai and talked about creating content for a community, about sort of communicating some of his ideas and self-expression through that content. And now you find yourself in the process of standing up servers to support people who support you, you know, yep. to commit to come through on your commitments there. But also now you also find yourself having to record the content to meet those commitments.
Yep.
And you find yourself transitioning from something you did because you enjoyed it into something that's starting to feel a little bit like work. Is that bad?
I don't actually feel that way at all. I still enjoy it. I just feel like I don't have enough time in the day to meet everything I need to do when it comes from that plus JB plus running the servers plus doing other stuff plus having any free time at all.
Our social life of any kind. Yeah. And the funny thing about it, and this is where I think we could pull in from Noah's story, is what often what ends up happening is you start working on something, and just the act of working on that thing becomes all consuming. And then there's a bunch of support tasks around it that you need help with.
Yeah.
How do you decide when to do that? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, currently I have no idea because I feel like I do need to like pass off some tasks already. Like I set a goal on my Patreon to eventually have an editor, but I feel like I'm already at the point that I need an editor because I don't have time to edit the content that I record. And I don't know how to transition to that when I don't have the level of income to hire an editor. And I was hoping that you guys might have some ideas as to, like, how did you get to the point where you could hire someone on?
So the first person I hired was the worst. That was the worst time of my life, because your small business becomes your baby and nobody will care about your child the way you care about your child. And I have learned to delegate with two main things that I look at. The first is a person's ability to do a given task. Do I have confidence in their ability to get the task done? And the second thing is, do I have confidence in their integrity? And I found that using those two things, I can weed out like 99% of people that shouldn't be put in charge of things. The first one's the hardest. Then after that, it gets a little bit easier. But the way, and I probably waited too long, quite honestly, to bring on the first person, but the way I look and evaluate when it's time to grow our team here is, when does that person produce more income than they cost me to bring on. And that applies to all of our staff here. Nobody in this business has ever gotten a raise because of cost of living or any stupid thing like that. If you want a raise, I'll give you a raise every 3 weeks if you can prove to me that you're bringing more value than that raise costs me. Obviously, that's very difficult to do, but I've had people walk in my office and they say, well, I wanted to talk to you about a raise. Great, cool, let's talk. Why do you think you should need a raise? Well, I've been here for X amount of days or X amount, no, sorry, sucking air for a certain amount of time doesn't equate to you being more valuable to me. You're just as valuable as when I hired you. It's when you do something more that we'll talk about it. And I evaluate bringing new people on the same way. When you get to a point where you say, if I could hire an editor, I could produce 5 shows a week, and then that 5 shows a week would bring me an X amount of dollars, and the editor only costs me Y, so it's mathematically worth it to bring on an editor.
I would agree with everything you're saying, except for I'm going to disagree with everything you're saying.
Okay.
That only works in the scenario in which you can afford to bring on a person to have them do that. Yep. And there is this, especially when it comes to making money on the internet, there is this... It's not like a temporary phase. There is sometimes a multi-year phase where you are not making enough money to do that.
To take the next step.
But you still got to produce it to even begin to get off the ground. And I think
that's where I am.
Yeah.
I don't believe in debt, though. So I the business to me.
I'm not saying go into debt. See, here's where I think this is where you and I might disagree is okay. I think you have to consider changing the product. To a degree, the product has to be sustainable. So what you got to do is you got to minimize, you got to look at what can I achieve, what is sustainable, and still meeting the quality bar that I'm comfortable putting my name on. Okay. And this is a hard learned lesson. I mean, even I still today have not learned this lesson, so I have no right to talk about this.
What do you mean by you have to take the next, where do you come up with the money?
Do you follow what I'm saying, Rika?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you would get it.
Well, in the tactical sense, where do you come up with the money to pay the person?
No. You change the product in such that you can deliver that yourself until you can financially. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Before Jupiter Broadcasting hired Rekai, I just simply did it. I did the shows I learned to do the shows live to tape, essentially.
Yeah. Okay.
And I learned to do the shows live to tape because. There was no way in hell I could carefully edit each one.
Sure.
In fact, user error is sort of a novel revisiting the idea of, hey, what if I only had to edit one show a week? How would I edit that show? That's this show. And that's because I have somebody to edit all of the other shows now. But because I, at one point, was editing all of the other shows, mm-hmm. I simply learned to do my audio cues live, the camera switching live, the green screening live, mm-hmm. all of that, because that meant I just had to chop the ends. I created a product that I could sustainably deliver by myself. Only now, kind of revisiting this entire concept, and that's where this show came.
You know, when we first licensed our phone number, or wasn't license, when we first signed up for our phone number, the recording that I had for the life of me, I can't remember who did it for me, but paid a guy to do a recording for me. The recording is actually the same today as it was on December 2009 when I opened. The difference is today, when you push 1 for sales, you get our sales team. When you push 2 for service, you get our service dispatcher. When you push 3 for billing, you get, whatever, right? Back then, all of those extensions rang my phone. So I would answer, and I would answer the phone. Here's the thing. You have to project. I believe that you have to project. You have to project success before you'll actually achieve it. So I would answer the phone. I never answer the phone. Hey, this is Noah. How can I fix your computer today? I'd answer the phone. Thank you for calling AltaSpeed. How can we help you? How can we help you? Okay. And then, I'd take it down. I'd say, okay, we will get a service technician out to you. And I actually had a unique experience. I had gotten one of the smaller jobs I had was I was working doing some web development for this group, and she emails out, and I said we can do this, and so we designed a web page for her, and they were thrilled, everything was great, and so she said we're looking to put a building up, and we need some structured wiring and all this stuff, and I said no problem, I'm going to send our senior technician over, and he'll survey the site, and then I'll actually have him on site.
You being the senior technician,
I was the only one, and
wow.
I said I'll send our senior technician over there, and he will survey the site and take care of everything. Oh, she goes, okay. So I go over there And she goes, "You're the guy that Noah sent over?" And I said, "Yep." And so I run all the network wire and I get everything set up and I get our server set up and I get all the workstations set up.
You didn't tell your name's Noah?
So I get an email later and she goes, "The guy that you sent over, he was incredible. He did all this work and everything's great and everything's running well. And we're just so thankful." And okay, great. So over the next, you know, month or so, we start dealing with some of these things. And eventually I go in. And she goes, "You know, you have to tell Noah, you know, this, that, or the other." And I said, "I'm Noah." And she looks at me and she goes, "Oh, you're Noah." And I said, "Yeah." And she goes,
How many
people work for you?" And I said, "Just me." And she's like,
"Oh, was that awkward?
Just you?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "How old are you?" And so I said, I'm 22 at the time, I think. I said, "I'm 22." And she goes, "Wait a minute. You're the only one supporting our network at 22 years old." And I said, "Yeah." Never heard from them again. That's not entirely true, because they did actually come back later when a different person had taken over. But that particular lady that was there, never heard from her again. And I don't know where she went. But I always thought that starting a business and being successful, it was a linear thing. You started at the bottom and you worked a little bit and you built a little steam and got a little bit and you worked your way up a mountain, right? That's really not how it is. It's more like you go halfway up the mountain, fall all the way to the bottom, go up three quarters of the way, fall halfway back down, go up a little bit more. And then when you finally get to the top, you're not standing on a bunch of success. You're actually standing on a pile of your own failures and you're just a little bit higher than you were before.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Rekai, what I'm trying to say to you, and I think you're overdoing it. You're overshooting, and you got to scale back and focus a little bit on something that you can. If I could give you any piece of advice after all of these years, make it as easy as fucking possible. As easy as fucking possible, because you want to do it when you're not feeling well. You want to do it when you're grumpy. You want to be able to do it. You want to be able to do it for fun, and it's only going to be fun when it's not a lot of work. So you got to make it as easy as possible. And I look back in the past at people I've worked with who I thought were lazy, and now I look back and I think maybe they were actually probably walking a line better than I was at the time. Mm-hmm. Because it's the lazy option is actually to overdo it and not to go back to what we just started with, like, because I feel like Noah sometimes does this, is just push extremely hard, just no matter what it takes, no matter what the personal cost is, no matter what the emotional expense is, push as hard as you can, you'll push through it. And sometimes that is what you have to do. Mm-hmm. We get into it when there's like Linux Fest live events. Mm-hmm. Like we do that. That's the mode you go into. Mm-hmm. And Noah, I think, goes into that mode about three times a week. But
I was definitely in it for the last 24 hours, that's for sure.
But yeah, I just feel like if you don't want to do it to something that you also want to enjoy, because one of the things that's great about your Let's Play videos is you generally do them in a, at least the way you come across is it's relaxing to listen to. It's comforting to listen to you, and it's comforting to watch. And part of it is because you are in a relaxed state. You are enjoying the process. And if that gets disrupted a lot, I would wonder if that would change the tone of the content, which is maybe it's sort of the nice appeal of your content when I listen to it.
Yeah.
So you got to make sure you don't overdo it, even though you want to be able to build this thing that could become sustainable and even maybe profitable one day.
And actually, speaking to the whole profit thing, what I would encourage you to do, and I think this might, if you change your perspective a little bit, and you actually, I think you're coming into it with this perspective, so I guess more what I'm saying is don't lose this. Go into it more with the perspective of, instead of saying, I want to make X amount of dollars, or I want to get X amount of, you know, sustainability out of it, just try to serve people well and provide them with something that they enjoy, and they will give you applause with certificates of appreciation that have little president's faces on them. I'm stealing that from Rabbi Lappin, but that's what I've found is far more success. Every time we have ever tried to formulate something based on cost, it seems to fall over. And every time we try to formulate something based around someone's need and serve that need well, we bill for it. You bet we capitalize the heck out of it. But people seem to be happy to pay that invoice, right? And it's kind of a difficult thing to quantify, because really that change is happening in your mind. It's not so much a practical thing. But I think it's really important that you keep that in mind. And I think a lot of people, especially people on YouTube that are doing independent content, nobody goes through the amount of work that it takes to make a video because they're trying to make $1 million off of ad revenue, right? You go into it because you're passionate about it and it's something that you want to do. And I think that's why people get initially interested in those videos to begin with, is because there isn't some commercial corporate drive.
I would say the biggest misconception, I think, from your average viewer. I don't think our audience is necessarily susceptible to this because they're a little more tech savvy, but your less tech savvy audience, I think, assumes that people that are on YouTube or people are making videos are just making tons of money. And I can assure you, you know, and not that Jupiter Broadcasting pulls down tens of thousands of views per video, but I would be shocked if last week's Linux Action Show broke $3 YouTube revenue generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'd
be better off working at McDonald's money standpoint. Yeah.
Could you imagine?
I basically need to have like a million viewers and because then you'll get like higher CPMs and make a crap ton of money.
I easily spent maybe double, probably triple that in gas money driving to the studio. So there's something going on that I don't know if we're ready to talk about it yet because I want to watch it play out, but it seems to be that there are camps forming in the Linux community. There is the people who feel like the only way to protect the GPL is to sue. And you have to go in the courts. It might as well be the BSD license unless you enforce it. If you never enforce it, then just why don't they use the MIT license? And then there is the camp who says enforcement is done differently. Enforcement is done through outreach, through decades of work, through working directly with developers inside companies and engineers over time to change the way they think about things, to have them create culture change inside their company, and then eventually create a company that is enthusiastically contributing to Linux and following the GPL. And the one camp, the camp that wants to kind of enforce it in the courts, says, here's the reality. These people are ripping us off today. They're stealing GPL code. They're making billions of dollars off it. And if you want to take 10 years to get them to turn around, good for you. But in 10 years, that product will be irrelevant and the transgression won't matter. We have to go after them today. We have to make the GPL matter. And the only way to do it is to prove it in the court. The other camp says, we want to work with these people. We want to make internal connections. And when you sue these companies, they shut down. They stop communicating with us. They immediately go to a different camp, perhaps the BSD camp or proprietary, or they stop contributing back. They stop participating in the mailing list. They stop giving us patches. You shut them down. And it kills all momentum. You're damaging our ability to work with them. And the two are just totally at loggerheads now. And I would say if you want to put names on it, you have Karen Sanders on the Software Conservancy side. And you have Greg KH on the kernel side, who was – and his position was most vocally articulated by Linus recently, which we talked about in the Linux Action Show. But Linus was actually just reiterating Greg's core concerns. There's been people who have speculated that, oh, well, this is Linux Foundation corruption. You see, the Linux Foundation is taking in money, and now they've been softened by violators like Microsoft and like VMware. And because they take money from these companies, they don't want to pursue them legally. But that doesn't actually logically stack up because Greg and Linus are also being paid by the Linux Foundation. And their positions are clearly about converting these companies to compliance just through a different tact. I don't want to lose my head on this particular issue because I feel like GPL enforcement is super important and validating it in court is just as important as validating it in code. At the same time, I can't help but look at the Conservancy and say, what are you actually creating other than issues? Do you feel where I'm coming from on this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that has been didn't wear on me so much the first in the early years. You know, when LinuxCon was first taking off and stuff like that, and OSCON and all the other ones, you know, it didn't bother me so much because I was coming heavily from a Windows conference, you know, side. And so just to see Linux there made me happy. And then as I got into some of the more smaller conferences like Linux Fest Northwest, and of course Southeast Linux Fest, and those, I started to see what Linux was really about and the community side of Linux.
And you got more excited, right?
Energized. Way more excited. Because the thing is, the people that are going to, I'll tell you here, and this is a classic example. Last time I was at one of the larger, I won't say which one, but last time I was at one of the larger conferences, we went to the conference and we went to a couple of the talks and did all this stuff. And then everyone went into their hotel rooms and shut the door. That was the end of it. because conference is over, right? Let's go back to our hotel rooms, right? I don't think I slept at Self from the time I got there until the time I got on the plane to come to Seattle to do our anniversary episode.
Surprise, surprise. That's the theme of this episode.
Yeah, I know, but it was, there was nonstop community. I mean, I literally get done with hanging out with Jeremy and then Emma wants to hang out. I literally get done with Emma and then, you know, this other guy from the Mumble Room wants to hang out. Like,
I watched this new rift forming in our community, And it makes me super sad because, like, we don't have a stake in this necessarily. Like, we don't know what these relationships are like. We have – there's two sides to this story. Like, I also heard a very cognate argument from a developer who said, we have had massive issues on the Android platform because Qualcomm and other – I think – I can't remember who else. He name dropped a few names. This is all in the LWN.net. He name drops a few vendors who are just absolutely – whole hog taking GPL code, not releasing any of their patches, and it is making life difficult for a lot of people. And they've begged them to release the code. They're in absolute violation of GPL in these developers' opinions, and nothing's happening. And so you could see where someone at the Software Conservancy like, I'm not going to wait 10 years for this situation to get resolved. These devices will be worthless in 10 years.
See, that's what I find interesting is like cases like that, where it's completely obvious that nothing's going to happen, I don't see the Software Conservancy going after those cases so much. Meanwhile, you've got stuff like the BusyBox stuff. The guy basically at the end said, I got nothing out of this except ill will. And like
– the BusyBox developer.
I feel like they're prioritizing the wrong projects if they are going to follow lawsuits. By suing these people, you're kind of just poisoning the well you drink from. And I don't see an upside to doing this. But at the same time, I can understand their point because there are obviously going to be companies out there that are just going to take advantage of the fact that the GPL is not being enforced. So I don't know what the solution is.
Reading the mailing list for Linus and Greg, I think you've sort of in a very succinct way summarized their thoughts on it too. And it feels like it both. I wish there was room for both in a way that didn't damage communities, but it would appear that so far the end result is we have really, like, BusyBox has really suffered. Wow, Rika, imagine a world where the conversation begins at the developer's level. Greg or Linus or somebody, I'm sure it's somebody else, is working with these people, whoever is, you know, the maintainer and the kernel for this particular area, and it starts there. And then when they get interest in the company, and we're gonna do this, we're gonna actually contribute in a proper way, but man, we have a lot of questions and we're not sure if some of these things might have IP that we've bought from somebody else and licensed. Imagine if then the conservancy stepped in and said, well, we have experts in this field and we'll absolutely work with you. Here's our fee. We can help guide you through this entire process as you make this transition. And man, I'll tell you what, that would be something I'd be totally willing to donate to.
Yeah,
I have donated to the conservancy and I've also donated in person. I've bought swag from Karen directly to support the conservancy. But now I look back at it and I think
we did it together at OSCON 2 years ago, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And I don't know if I'm happy with how my money's been spent. Let's take a brief deviation just to sort of light up the mood. I noticed real quickly in the video interview you did with Chris from the school on Sunday that he did quote unquote grilling for you.
Yes.
He quote unquote grilled.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could paint a picture for me.
Okay.
You know me, I actually just want you to make me jealous, but
yes.
I picture you on a gorgeous 40 acres.
Yeah, 46. He actually hasn't even walked his whole property. He runs out of energy to get from, like, he can't walk. You know, it's obviously very heavily forested, so he can't get to his property.
Yeah, that's nice.
Okay,
and
that's how far away from anyone. Yeah,
you're okay. And so you go there, you park your little home on wheels there. You got the family there.
That's right.
Now all of a sudden, it's a nice summer vacation.
Yeah, he's got kids, and I've got kids, so the kids are entertained, and there's a bonfire.
Oh, man. Oh,
you know, away
man.
From everyone.
So does
else.
He? Is it his house? Does he show up with his rig? Does he got a barbecue in tow?
That's
paint the scene
it's,
for me.
It's his house, and he actually has a. So he has a gorgeous property, but he's got outside of his house. He's got this like gazebo kind of a thing that has a roof but no walls, so you can literally grill 365 days out of the year, right? And yes. And so he's got a permanent grill set up. In fact, I think there were actually two grills, one really super nice big one.
Propane.
And then a small one. Propane, yes. And there was like every meat known under man on the grill. I chose to go with, I think I did a burger and I did a couple of hot dogs just because I was a simple guy. But
wait, are you doing the grilling or
no,
was Chris doing
it? No, he totally, he just like.
And you just step back and like, I'm not going to even get involved here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't
That's hard for you.
I don't do pork products, and so he got me turkey bacon, and so wow.
Did you like pre-telegram this? Or, I
no,
mean, the turkey bacon thing. That's yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you
maybe,
are right.
Maybe ask me or maybe ask Sarah. I don't know.
You mentioned that this Chris guy was super observant.
Yes, very much so. But he
that's another level.
How you know this sounds like just somebody who should be a podcaster.
I didn't even know that yeah. Noah didn't eat bacon.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's like the only thing he does that's weird. I know.
No, the other thing I don't do like any sort of salad. I don't do any sort of rabbit food.
No, that's just an unfortunate state of the American.
I'm on the same page as Noah.
See, the thing about you not eating green things and only drinking Coca-Cola is like legitimately a beautiful product of the United States of America. The you not eating pork thing.
Well, I mean, I don't eat pork products either, but I do eat bacon.
Yeah, that would be a pork product.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, but to me, bacon is like different than all the other pork products, like pulled pork.
I feel like we should get into that in a future episode. But so, okay, so he's got you the turkey bacon.
Yes.
And
hot dogs, and burgers, and Doritos, and regular potato chips, and a bunch of little like condiment things or whatever. And he opens the fridge and he's like, here, I put some stuff in the fridge for you. And top shelf, beer. Second shelf, Coke. Third shelf, different kind of beer. Fourth shelf, different kind of beer. Fourth shelf, more Coke. Like, just a fridge of beer and Coke. And I'm like,
so this is a guy that this is a guy that's watched a lot of Linux Action Show.
It was amazing. Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Well, here's a question, Noah. Were the potato chips, were they all dressed?
Oh, yeah, the corn. Yeah, the corn. So he has this corn that he got, and the corn is from this like local farmer. So it is the sweetest, most crisp tasting corn. Like it falls off the cob. Now the problem was there was so much butter on this corn that it's like running down my arms, right?
Okay.
And like I can't get the butter off, and the butter and salt is like and juice is spraying all over the place.
This is where you went wrong. See, you just messed up because
I didn't mess up. It was amazing.
The sweet corn in the United States, yeah, that's all over the place. But in Washington, nobody does sweet corn like Washington does sweet corn.
Oh, you think Washington does everything?
Oh, come on, that is not true. We have the worst cops ever. Now, let me say this. I will tell you, I was out at 9:30 a.m. on my Weber grill, literally barbecuing corn this morning. Sweet corn.
I think he means grilling.
I was grilling. Grilling sweet corn that was picked from probably 6 miles from where I live. And this stuff, Noah, it's like sugar. I mean, it is just so delicious. And what I do, Noah, is I have a little coconut salt. It's a little bit of Johnny's and coconut oil that I rub the corn in, and then I put it right on top of the coals. The coals are right underneath the grill, Noah. Hey, Hadia, are you out there? You got to come in here. Here's the thing, Noah. Were you getting KFC?
No. I was going for a walk, baby.
What was the food out there?
I got hungry.
So what was the food?
What do you mean? The food on the counter that I pulled out of the garbage because you threw it away too soon?
Are you serious?
Listen, my blood sugar was low, and I knew that cinnamon roll I got you was still good.
Oh, my God, baby. You just ate a great... You're fucking George Costanza over here.
And that was a new garbage bag. I checked.
Yeah,
I looked, and I decided it was okay.
You had to go down deep, though, to get that, because it was a new bag. So you were reaching out.
Yeah, but there was like one empty bag of something, and there was. I assessed the situation, and the seal was still good, and I sniffed it. I ate a little bit, you know, a homeopathic amount of it. I went for a walk. I was still okay. I ate the rest.
But I think what really the sweet corn was good. But I think what really sold the sweet corn at the barbecue today that we had, we ate it, put it in our mouths today before we even just drove down here moments ago, was that compound butter.
Yeah.
What the hell was it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was sheer genius and not completely my own.
Can I, by the way, do I have your permission to share the picture of you preparing it?
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
Okay.
It'll
be in the show
dorky.
Notes.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I looked up how to make a compound butter, and I've made them before, but never tried to make them look decent or presentable. And I have an old hand-me-down Cuisinart that I love, but I keep it in my office because I've got more countertop space. So I thought, how do I do this by hand? in the rig when the butter is not yet at room temperature. So what you got to do with compound butter is you take whatever herbs, you can do any herbs you want, any real seasoning that you want, and room temperature butter, and you whip it together, usually in a Cuisinart or some food processor. Well, we didn't have such equipment, but that was not going to stop me. I had jalapenos and Hatch chili peppers and some smoked paprika, and I thought, well, I can put these all together. So I took out a couple blocks of butter, and I was trying to figure out how to get them at room temperature. Now, here's the thing. You can't just melt it. If you melt it, it separates, and I'm going to screw this up, but I might be right, and it sounds professional, so I'm going to say it. The milk solids from the actual oil in the butter.
Sure, yeah.
If you separate it, if you ever melt butter in the microwave for popcorn, then you've got a little bit left and you go to melt it again or you go to spread it, it's totally different. It's gritty. It's weird. It's not the type of butter you want to spread on anything. So you have to just soften it. So what I ended up doing was putting it on top of a stool, two bricks of butter on top of this folding stool over the heating vent. And I just kept rotating it until it softened a little. And I thought, okay, this is almost good. It took about a half hour. Oh, that was pretty decent. Okay, so then I'm searching around for a glass bowl. Found a glass bowl, and I start mashing up the butter. Not quite soft enough. And if it's not quite soft enough, then some of it's going to blend with the herbs, and some of it's not, and you're going to have big chunks of unblended. Yeah, no good. So I broke down and sat down on the floor with the bowl of butter and a spoon, and I just mashed at it right over the heater, primitive style.
I thought it was sort of like ingenious because it was just enough heat. It was not necessarily the most efficient way to do it. And it turned out to be a pretty good butter. It had a little bit of heat. Yeah. It had some smokiness to it. And because the corn had been roasted on the grill, then that adding that additional smoky on top of it. So you had the sweet corn with the smoky hot heat. But it was the kind of heat that like it wasn't – what I liked about it is it was smoky on the front, hot on the back. So you would swallow it, and your first sensation was sort of a nice smoky sweet flavor, and then as you sort of ingested it down into your animal stomach, you got the heat in your mouth. Yeah, right,
it's like the mullet of the culinary world.
Okay, there's only one way to answer this. You're gonna have to make this corn and a lot of it, and then I'll have to try it.
Rikai, it's like bingo with Noah.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. So, okay, let's just, I'm going to write a few things down. And okay. Rikai's here in the studio with me.
Okay.
I'm going to write a couple things down.
Okay.
Let's see.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a good idea, Chris. We need a JB bingo.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really lost right now.
I don't have a lot of time live. I'm just going to write these things down. So I wrote, and it's the handwriting is horrible.
Handwriting's horrible.
And I'm guessing one of these two things is true about you. So did you get a new phone for this trip?
Me?
Did you pick up, you, huh?
Me?
Yeah, did you get a new phone for the trip?
No.
Okay. Did you get a new laptop for the trip?
First question is, you're right, that if I did get a new phone. I didn't get a new smartphone. I didn't get a new smartphone, but I got a new dumb phone. Mm-hmm. I got a GSM unlocked dumb phone. I did get a new phone because, in fact, it was a dedicated one that I used in case I got kidnapped. Then I could call the police while not having to cancel the stream.
Yeah, sure,
and actually, yes, I did use a different laptop too this time.
So, I mean, because I know you're going to be in the rig. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit smaller. You're going to be moving around. Mm-hmm. You probably want some portability.
Nice little, powerful little netbook.
Something that, yeah, would still get the job done, maybe have a nice battery. Is this sounding like something you might do before you go on a trip like this?
Could be, but in this particular case, it wasn't.
Oh!
I'm sorry.
I thought I would have nailed you. I wrote it down, right? Yep. I got the new phone thing right, so I'm 50-50.
Yeah. What was the netbook you thought I was going to get?
I thought you were going to get a ZenBook.
I wish I had the money for that right now. So the thing is, I need to get my hands on one of these in person. Because from what I understand, these things are, this is like the nicest, this is like one of the nicest builds of a non-Apple laptop that exists right now. And I really want to see if the rumors are true.
You're talking about the ZenBook Pro UX 501, which looks to me like a Windows 10 tablet keyboard combo thing.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of the tablet part of it, but basically it has a super high resolution IPS display.
And 3840 by 2160.
And you'll be happy because it has actual graphic. It has an actual graphic card in it, but yet it appeals to me because it is an ultrabook, so it's very very thin and light, and I have a couple of, I've owned a number of Zen books, and all of them have been like right out of the box, works flawlessly with Linux. And so I was just kind of looking at it and I'm like, man, this could be a computer. And it's one that, you know, you're going to pay for, right? Like it's not a budget computer by any stretch of the imagination. I think they start at like 1500 and then they top out at like 17.
Scott, so the looks like the base, or at least the one on the one you sent me, i7 quad core CPU, GTX 960, a 512 gigabyte SSD, and 16 gigabytes of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
It is pretty nice and it's super, super thin. We'll have a link in the show notes if you guys want to look at it.
So just to give you an alternative, Noah.
If you bring up that 29-inch laptop thing that you sent me.
No.
All right. Well, no, we should talk about that. That thing's badass. Geez.
But before we do that, so I know you like these. So recently on the subreddit, somebody posted that they got everything working in Arch Linux except for the touchscreen.
Oh, on the Surface?
On the Surface Book 4.
Nice! I have a friend that has a Surface Book 4 that says I can install, Alex, says I can install Linux on his work-issued Surface Book Pro as long as I don't break it.
Yeah.
Man, dude. No, don't do it on Alex.
No, we're totally going to do it on Alex. Listen, the absolute worst thing that happens is he doesn't have plates when he flies a plane. How bad could that be?
Yeah.
No, I think, Noah, that if you're going to do it, in this case, it has to be a dual boot.
I don't really do dual boots.
So I don't get you, man. I don't get you, Noah. You're coming at me with this Oryx Pro a couple of weeks ago. This massive machine, just this huge beast of a rig.
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work for me. I was a 15-inch laptop kind of guy, and so I was like, I can go back to that. I can go back to taking a computer, and then I would just have one computer. I could do Lasson. I could do video editing. I could do all my work stuff. I can do a 15-inch laptop. I can't do the 17-inch. I can do the 15-inch. And when we were at System 76 and I held that Oryx, and I was like, wow, what a balance between super, super powerful machine, and still it's not a tank. It's not a bonobo. It's actually portable. It feels like a laptop to me. But it just took a couple weeks, and I was just like, you know what? It's still a great computer, and I still love it for what it is.
Still have it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it is getting adopted by my father, I believe.
So what specifically made it unappealing?
I just found myself not taking it. I found myself leaving the house and going, I'm going to go out to, well, you know what? Just screw it. I'll use one of their computers and disconnect the thing and take it with me and just pack it up and whatever. And so, and after like a little bit of doing that, I was like, you know what? I'm just a 13-inch laptop kind of guy. And I just take it. And of course now that addiction has gone even further because now I have this stupid Surface and it just doesn't leave my side. Like I just take it everywhere with me. I don't even walk out of the house. I carry it under my arms. I got here and I carried it in. Yeah, it's horrible.
Well, I have been where you're at, and yet I find myself
wanting almost, the power.
I almost every other day I'm configuring an Oryx Pro on System 76 website, and
PMing it to Noah,
and watching the price of Bitcoin, which is up right now, by the way. Which, let me tell you, if it keeps going up, I'm gonna like, oh shit, I should get that Oryx Pro.
You're gonna get one of those 21-inch laptops.
So then I saw this thing, and this is the Acer Predator 21X.
Rakai sent this to both Chris and myself.
Oh yeah, Rika, you should tell the story. Yeah, tell the story, Rika.
Well, I sent the link to both of them because I found the laptop both intriguing and hilarious, and then So I sent the link to both of them, and they had completely opposite reactions. Chris was excited by it. He's like, that hardware is awesome. This is great. And then Noah,
I was like, I kind of want one. I want one.
Noah's response was something along the lines of, you got to be kidding me. This is a joke, right?
To be exact, I sent him a picture of a crane and said, here, look, the laptop case for that computer.
Yeah.
The thing is, I understand, like, I can kind of get my head wrapped around a portable desktop. Like, that's kind of cool. I kind of get that. And that can be kind of useful. And at the same time, I don't buy into it at all. Like, a laptop should be portable, extremely portable. And when you get to the point, especially with that behemoth, when I have to start buying, like, custom leg supports for my desk just so that it doesn't collapse it, like, when the thing weighs more than I do, I just...
So I think it's like 17 pounds.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's got a 21, a 21-inch screen, though.
Curved display.
Curved, wide display. And it, just to give you a size, if you don't want to look at the link in the show notes, just to give you an idea of the size, it actually has a keyboard armrest that folds out. That's how big this thing is. But at the same time, I look at this and I think something like this or an Oryx or whatever it is, it honestly, for me, could be the perfect high-end gaming computer for me. Because I, in the RV, Noah and Rikai, I don't really see myself wanting to set up a desktop PC with a tower and a keyboard and a mouse and a monitor. Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know where I would put that.
I know exactly where you put it. You'd put it above your television, and you would have one of those wireless keyboards, and so basically your TV would become.
I couldn't use a TV as my primary display.
Really,
I couldn't do it.
No, even if it was 1080p.
No. Not it. I'm not only am I a resolution snob these days, but now I'm also a PPI snob.
Well,
so
then on top of that, you've got the fact that TVs have high input lag, and then you're adding a wireless keyboard on top of that, which is adding more input lag. Mm. You are not a gamer, Noah, if you think that you can game on a wireless keyboard and a television.
Hey, fight me, Atlanta. Fight me 1v1.
Sure, I'm going to win because you have a crappy wireless keyboard.
No, you won't. By the way.
No, you won't. I'll no-scope you.
This thing has a mechanical, by the way, this 21-inch laptop has a mechanical keyboard in it.
Like, that is amazing.
Yes, I know. That's why I want one. I honestly am thinking about emailing them and be like, here's the issue, is I know that they're not building this thing for Linux, and so it's hard for me to justify a review unit, because I'm like, hey, can I try putting Linux on this and then document how it fails? Yeah, sure, Chris, we'll send you that.
Did you see the back of that system where it looks like...
As long as you pay the $575, it'll cost
like
the
grill of a car or something?
Yeah, it does. It's a little excessive on the cooling, I think, but yeah, that's probably not a bad thing.
It's got a GTX 1080 in it, though.
Yeah, but the GTX 1080s, I don't know. I mean, they're not – I think they run cooler than the 9 series, don't they?
Well, the 1070 does, but the 1080 runs hotter than anything.
Oh, and this does have a 1080 in it.
Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh.
And, of course, all their new chips are all desktop chips for all laptops now. So – there's going to be a boost in heat output there, too.
Does it ever make you consider it ever? Would you ever, ever, ever get a laptop for gaming, Rikai?
No.
But if you were going to get a laptop for gaming, this would be it.
If I traveled a lot, I'd get a laptop for gaming, probably.
But it wouldn't be your main gaming computer.
Yeah. When I was home, if I were home, I'd just use the desktop.
You know, when we built some new rigs during Linux Fest Northwest, it was the first time I'd used a new desktop in since like 2011 or something. Mm-hmm. And it is so much faster than a laptop. Like, just everything is faster. Everything. And I really enjoy using the desktop for any task I can here at the. And in fact, it makes me kind of more inclined to work at the office than it does at home, because I just enjoy working on the desktop so much more. A multi-monitor setup with different crazy ass resolutions. I got one vertical, one horizontal. I got way faster disk IO, way faster internet. I got Ethernet to everything. I'm never on Wi-Fi. It's always on. It's just, and I got disks for days.
See, for me, if I were traveling too, I wouldn't get that laptop either. I would get some sort of something similar to the Razer Blade, where it's light and it's 15 inches, but it's still powerful.
No,
13 inches.
Well, there's a 13 inch too. No,
okay,
but
and it still has the GPU, right?
Those are
pretty expensive.
That specifically, I would use that if I
started $1,800.
If I were traveling between work and home as a video editor and I wanted my own system that I could take home with me.
You're saying I should get one?
You know, actually, just looking at the bottom of that.
I feel like that thing is uniquely suited for you, Chris.
The other thing that is super appealing to me for my next laptop, and this is where the Oryx is a little murky and I don't know how I would do this, is I really like the idea of a docking station.
Oh my God. It changes you, because the part of it is I, you know, a lot of us are looking at syncing solutions because we want to move seamlessly from one machine over to the other. But really, we don't want to move from one machine to the other. We want to move from one location to the other. You want to start up in your office and work where it's comfortable and then go down into your blazing hot studio, because that's where all the equipment is. So you have to record down there, and then you have to take it back to your RV, which is where you sleep at night, so that makes sense to have your computer there. And so really, we use all these different kinds of ubiquitous syncing solutions and stuff to try to mitigate what the real answer is, which is I want access to my computer everywhere I go. And so I literally have a docking station at my office and a docking station at my house. And they're true docking stations. It's not docking station where I have to plug in three cables. Device. Exactly. I literally set the computer down in a specific part of my desk, and power is connected, and the computer is charging, and my USB keyboard and mouse are connected, and my three monitors are connected, and my audio speakers are connected, and a wired gigabit LAN is connected, and all this stuff just instantly goes into my computer. And then when I get up, I can take it back to my house. And there are days where I just bounce between my office and my house, and it's just going from one docking station to the other. I forget I have a laptop. And then I get to a client location and I'm like, oh yeah, I was working on that document back in my, hey, let's just pull this thing out. Oh, two of my screens are gone and now all these windows are all on one screen, but hey, all my stuff is here and this is where I left off. That's a cool that's a cool feeling. Plus for you specifically, Chris, being able to do all your show prep upstairs and then walk downstairs and be able to display all of that content on air, man, that would be invaluable.
The other thing that would be really nice is back up at Lady Jupiter, if I had like my audio interface and mm-hmm. the HDMI out devices always wired into the docking station.
Yep.
So that was not changing all the time. Because the problem I have with a laptop without a docking station is you really for best results want to plug everything back into the same spot. I know exactly. That sounds like hocus pocus, but it's true.
It is.
And if you have a docking station where everything just remains always plugged in, I just simply remove the laptop from that situation and I plug it back in. Man, I think that would work great for me.
And somebody maybe in the chat room or in the audience can maybe tell me how this works, but it has some way of profiling it, because when I am at my office dock station, it remembers the layout I have. Even though I have the identical model displays at my office and at my home, there's only two of them in my office and there are three at my house. And somehow, you know, like, so my primary one in my house is the center one, and then I've got one on the right and one on the left. And at my office, I have one and then just one over to the right. And somehow it knows I'm at my office or I'm at my house after I set it up the first time. So there must be some sort of profiling in the dock.
I know there is a way. I bet somebody in the audience does know.
Yeah.
Somebody should leave a comment. I wanted to wrap us up on just kind of touching on Rikai's journey that he's beginning, and something that Noah said that he discovered and hit early on in his. Reflecting back, Noah, you said something that I could relate a lot with, and that was – when you had convinced this guy that you were worth his time and you could work on his system, he's mm-hmm. like, okay, now create me a bid and a time order and all this stuff and send it to me. Mm-hmm. And you blanked and he eventually said, oh, you don't know what these things are. Mm-hmm. So the first time I ever sold advertising on the Jupiter Broadcasting Network, I was pretty happy with the way it went. It went really smooth. And I had worked, you know, in client relations for a while. So I kind of understood that relationship and how to build that dynamic.
You know how to sell, yeah.
And that had gone really great. And then we wrap up the conversation and she says, okay, great. Just send me an insertion order and we'll get this thing started.
Chris opened up Google.
And I said, okay, we'll have that off very soon. Yeah. And I went and I started Googling insertion order, which insertion does not, first of all, let me just say, it took me a little while to figure it out because it was a radio term. And I remember that whole moment I had where it was just sort of, I'm each step of the way I grow and I expand and I learn something new. And so my world just, my world started very small and it expanded very quickly and it sometimes caught me off guard and I had to kind of learn on the go because really what I had to do is I had to figure out what the hell an insertion order was. Then I had to figure out how to make one look professional, even though I'd never seen one in my entire life.
Yeah. You know a trick that I use, Chris, is, and I've done this numerous times. There's Lewis Rosman, who we've talked about on the air before, there's another guy who Tommy Jordan, who uses he owns a company called Twisted Networks, and I've picked his brain about a couple of different things, and then there's a guy in Minneapolis who probably doesn't want me talking about him on the air, but I've poked all three of those guys for various things, and they're kind of doing the same thing, but we're no competition to each other because we have drastically different markets. And, you know, Tommy, for example, I'll use him because I know he doesn't mind, you know, the public attention. He primarily focuses on Windows stuff. And so I have no interest in dealing with his Windows problems and he has no interest in dealing with my Linux problems. And so it's a mutually beneficial relationship. There are practices that he does that I have taken on. And I would like to think that there are practices that I do that he could take on.
I feel like you and I.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yeah,
and
for
I
sure.
are Rikai's Tommy. We're Rikai's Tommy right now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where is Tommy? There you go, Rikai. So I hope your Tommy session was useful for you.